Welcome back on SportsTalkNetwork.com and also the SportsTalkCleveland.com affiliate here. Rick Morris, Elaine Tanko, and fellow original dignitary Tim Faust joining us here tonight, the FDH Lounge on the Sports Talk Network. What a first hour, what a banner first hour this is. We go into talking to Arch Sleaster to start the show here, to another athlete, very well known for his career in Ohio here. Started off in the Cleveland Indians organization, very painful memory to both Tim and myself when this gentleman was traded away, but he went on to have a heck of a career, the bulk of the best years with the Cincinnati Reds here, multi-time All-Star. He is now an analyst for the Major League Baseball Network, and among other things, a noted fan of professional wrestling. We'll be hitting that as well. I can only be speaking of the man who had been voted at one point in time the friendliest guy in Major League Baseball, and after having talked to him off air, I didn't have a vote in that poll, but I certainly would have cast one. I can only be speaking of the mayor, Sean Casey. Sean, welcome to the FDH Lounge, sir. Good to have you in.
Rick, what's up, brother? Thanks for having me, man.
Hey, it is tremendous to have you in here, Sean, and it's funny, you know, I told you off air I was going to mention us on air, but, man, I was just MFing John Hart for a week when he traded you, man. I was just sick.
Well, you know I work with him now at MLB Network, and I asked him one time when we first were on set. I was like, hey, come on, man. My dream was to play, you know, at Jacobs Field for years to come. You traded me. Why'd you trade me? He's like, oh, we needed pitches. We needed Dave Burba. I said, oh, okay, I understand, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, you should have gotten us more than Dave Burba. That's what I think, you know.
Well, Burba had a couple good years for you guys.
Yeah, but you know, 380 at Akron should get you more than a number three
pitcher.
You know
what? Thanks a lot, Rick. If you were my agent back then, maybe I'd still be with the Indians.
Yeah, yeah, you would have been, man. You would have been. I guarantee you that. Well, you know what? You mentioned the Indians here, and you know, my boy here has got a question. I know on that subject.
Yeah, I find myself, Sean, this is Tim Faust. Pleasure to
up,
be joined
Tim?
By you. How you doing? You know, I find myself defending or having to defend Mark Shapiro, now Chris Antonetti, and the Indians, and the whole small market, big market thing. Grade the Indians now. Where are they right now? Where are they going?
Well, you know what? Listen, I am, and I'll tell you what. If you ask anybody around baseball, I mean, you guys have had a tough couple years. But if you get, by far, you guys have the best front office as far as Mark Shapiro and Chris Antonetti go. Period. I mean, you could ask anybody. I mean, Mark Shapiro is part of a group right now that meets with Bud Selig, with Mike Socia and Joe Torre and Tony La Russa, and I can't tell you how many people have gotten back. Bud Selig has told, wow, I can't believe how sharp Mark Shapiro is and all this stuff. Listen, they got the right leadership in that organization. They just have to, you know, obviously there's tough times right now. They're getting hit hard with the economy as far as money goes. The Dolan's putting money really back in that club. They're still doing a good job of developing players, but those guys are probably a couple years away from getting there. Obviously, the Carlos Santana hopefully comes back from that injury. Michael Brantley in that trade. Hopefully, Matt LaPorta can start stepping up a little bit and, you know, after getting his feet wet this year and have some more success next year. But, you know, like I said, I mean, they have the right owner leadership there in Mark Shapiro and Chris Antonetti.
Respectfully, Mr. Mayor, and it's already been well established how much I love you. Boy, I couldn't disagree more. I mean, for everything that I've seen, I am very disaffected. I'll tell you what, too. Everybody wants to point to the minor league titles they won this year. I did a little research on that. It's kind of funny. They won 7 minor league titles between 2003 and 2009. And who came out of that bunch? You know, it's just the drafting, at least until 08, has been horrible. I mean, for a front office that acts like they invented baseball and has been able to, you know, convince some people of that, I mean, geez, there hasn't been a whole lot to show for it. The draft's better. Recently, I think, have been a little bit better. But, boy, it's, you know, it's been tough. Now, you mentioned the Dolans also, and I guess that's my biggest rub, you know, is the bottom line of the team.
Right. And I think sometimes, listen, the draft sometimes is hit or miss. When you're building your team through the draft, you know, like Adam Miller, the guy who was going to be a total stud, ends up getting hurt, and his career's probably over. You know what I mean? That's just the way it goes sometimes. You take a gamble on a first-round pick. Well, when you build your team through the draft, that's what happens. If those guys end up getting hurt or not panning out, you end up struggling for a couple years, and that's just the way it goes. And you had to get rid of CeCe Sabathia. I mean, it's a shame when you see the number one starter for the Yankees is CeCe Sabathia. The number one starter for the Rangers is Cliff Lee. I mean, you know, you can go down the list of guys that were, you know, were stud players for them, but just a tough – they just can't hold on to them.
Well, and that's why I always go back to that I think the strategy over the last 6, 7, 8 years with the Indians has been spot on what they needed to do, but the execution has been poor. I mean, as a defender of the Indians, there's no way I can defend the fact that the drafts have been terrible. But, you know, on the other side of that, you got to admit, Rick, that they have redeemed themselves somewhat through trades.
They have, but, I mean, is it not kind of damning, Sean, that you have to point to something like that? I mean, you know, the Chu thing, obviously, I thought at the time the Chu trade was a good one when they made it. He was a darn good prospect to get for Ben Broussard when he was going, and on down the line, you know, Santana for Blake. I mean, obviously, yeah, I have to be fair and point to those things, but it is sort of damning when you have to sell off what you have on your roster in order to be able to bring in this caliber of player. You have no margin for error, supposedly.
Well, I mean, that is the truth, but I mean, I think the bottom line, too, is that really starts from the top, and that really starts from ownership saying, okay, we're able to put $80, $90 million into the team, $100 million into the team, and in Cleveland's case, you can't do that. And then in Cleveland's case, you know, that's why you lose all your front, you know, you had to trade a Victor Martinez, which, you know, I know firsthand broke Mark Shapiro's heart having to trade a guy like that. I mean, you got to end up doing it, and those are the guys you have to, you know, end up having to trade. And try and get something back in return to try and move forward in you know, in the economic times of Cleveland.
Well, you know, in terms of, and I agree with that. I mean, that's, you know, anybody that's going to mention anything with the Dolans, I'm going to be a big fan of theirs because, yeah, there's got to be a commitment to be able to match, you know, what you're trying to do here. But as far as on the macro level here, some of the bigger stories of the year in baseball, when you look at, again, not just the plethora of no-hitters, perfect games, also the one-to-nothing games, you know, that we saw during the season here, it's sort of been a thesis of ours that we've had that the number of ace pitchers in baseball, depending on how you would define them, but it seems to have almost, you know, maybe a little bit more than doubled in the last couple of years. We did a little bit of a study on this and said that arguably it went from about 10 to about 25 on that as far as guys that are really hammers out there. Do you agree with that, and where does that place among the bigger stories of the year in baseball?
I mean, the pitching has been unbelievable this season. There's no doubt about it, and it is amazing to look down at a list of frontline starters and guys. I mean, you look at Roy Halladay tonight. I don't know if you guys are following that game, but it's one out in the ninth. He's got a no-hitter going.
Yeah.
You know, it's been pretty impressive. But you go down the list of guys. It has been. I think the biggest thing this season is pitching. Yeah, you see the 1-0 games, and you know, pitching has been up big time. And you know, I don't know exactly why. I don't know if it's a sign of the times or it's a sign of the home of guys just you know, striking out more nowadays. But I mean, you've seen a lot of big time pitchers. I mean, you're seeing more and more of guys like Yubaldo Jimenez and the Roy Halladays, you know, CeCe Sabathia, Cliff Lee. You're seeing guys absolutely go out there and being able to dominate. And it is amazing to see the transition of a few years ago, you know, all the home runs and all that stuff, and now it's starting to get back to, like, real baseball where, you're seeing good, great pitching is shutting down great hitting.
You know, and that's an interesting point there because, you know, it's been that turn in the game in the last couple of years, and you mentioned what it's been the last couple of years, you know, with hitting, you know, more so, I guess, up to the early to mid part of the last decade. I look at a career like yours. You had a really wonderful career, you know, three-time, you know, all-star there, you know, tremendous batting average. It's funny because, you know, we had our first guest on here tonight, Art Schleister, who was somebody who really kind of had his foibles and really dealt with some bad kind of things. I look at your career. Do you stop and look at that? I'm sure you take a lot of satisfaction from the way that you did it, because I'm going to throw a name out there. Not that I think he's a juicer, but basically your career, I mean, if you'd roided it up, maybe you'd have been Jeff Bagwell or somebody. But and again, I'm not saying that he was a roider. I'm using that as an example of a power-hitting first baseman. But right. You had an excellent career, and you did it the right way. How much satisfaction do you take from that in an era where so many around you were dishonest?
I do take a lot of satisfaction. I really do. You know, and for me, too. I mean, I wasn't the guy that went down the street. This guy's going to definitely be a great big league ball player. I mean, really had to work at it. Really had to, you know, lift some honest weights and really get after it every offseason to try and be the best player I was. And, you know, it's funny, too, because when I played, you know, I remember in 99 I hit 25 homers, and the next year I hit 20 homers, and then a couple years later I hit 24, and they're like, oh, how come you're not really that power-hitting first base, you're not hitting 40 home runs? And I'm thinking to myself, 15 years earlier I'm top five homers at hitting 25, 24. You're starting to see the home runs come down now. More guys are in the 20s and 30s than are in the 40s and the 50s. So, you know, I guess for me, too, I was probably a little naive to it, too, back then, you know, thinking that, you know, everyone was clean and that, you know, no one was juicing, and I guess that's come to light now. But when I look in the mirror and I'm able to tell my kids, you know, my son my 7-year-old son Jacob asked me the other day, he said, "Dad, you know, because they know about the whole steroid stuff," and asked me, "Did you ever do steroids?" And I said, "Nope." And, you know, I never did steroids. And I can honestly, you know, look my kids in the eye and say, you know, Dad never did any steroids and anything like that. And you know, I look at some of the guys and think, I think Jason Giambi and I were kind of the same type of hitter of a doubles, you know, in the gap guy, maybe 20-some home runs. And he ends up making $150 million because he's hitting 45 homers a year. Do you think, man, it would have been, you know, nice to be that guy or you know, you'd have gone to All-Star games every year? But you know what? I think when I look back, I'm proud that I did it the right way. I'm proud that I didn't, you know, and I think for kids out there to know, too, like, not everybody's doing steroids and is successful in the big leagues or in professional sports. Like, there's a lot of people that are doing it the right way, and I'd say the majority of guys are doing it the right way and having success with it.
Hey, Sean, is baseball clean now? Is this all behind us, or are there going to be other shoes that are going to fall?
I really think, listen, if it's not totally clean, you'd have to be crazy to be doing in this environment, in this atmosphere. You'd have to be crazy to be doing performance enhancing drugs now. I mean, I really believe that. I mean, I think you can look at the guys and say it has cleaned up big time. And I don't think the guys are as big as they used to be, you know, or they look more like a normal person than Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know. So I think you're starting to. I think it's really cleaned up. I think the drug testing program that they have in place is really big. And I know recently they're talking about maybe trying to get a blood test going that can test HGH. You know, I think that's one of the final steps too. But you know, they test those guys three times a year. They can test them in the off season, and I really believe that it's cleaned up big time.
Hey, Sean, two things about what you said about your career. One, you know, and you mentioned about, you know, having the conversation with your kids. I got the word from our producer, Steve Cervillo. Congratulations on the birth of your latest child, first and foremost. Want to get that out there.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. Yeah, little girl, Jillian, she's almost 6 months old, which I can't believe. But she's, you know, she's just starting to do some things. But I appreciate that. Thanks.
Wonderful.
Tell Steve, thanks.
Well, I got to tell you also, too, on a quasi-humorous note, you talked about your best years power hitting. Tim and I are in a 20-team fantasy keeper league. Let me tell you something. I would give my left nard if James Loney would show the power that you had shown in your best years. And I've been waiting for that.
You keep him in your keeper league every year.
Yeah, I got him for $1, so I can't complain about that. But, geez, you know, you want to talk slappies, Sean. That guy's a slappy, not you.
I personally love James Loney as a hitter just because he's a gap guy. But he's still, Rick, okay, he doesn't have the big home run numbers, but he still drives in some runs.
He does. Yeah. I can't harsh on him completely for that, but that just kind of came to mind when you were talking about first baseman and power.
Well, since you threw out a selfish thing, I'm going to throw out a selfish
thing. Go ahead.
Sean, what's wrong with Matt Wieters, and is he going to come back next year?
Okay.
That's a great question. I was just talking to Tom Verducci about that, who I think wrote that big article on him in Sports Illustrated. We were on the set together the other day, and I'm on the network, and I said, "Hey, bro, is this Matt Wieters going to end up being like the next Joe Mauer, like we've proclaimed him to be?" And he's, you know, I think he's going to be a good big league ball player. I think his swing's a little long, I really do. And I think he's going to be, he's going to play 10 years in the big league, but I don't think he's going to be anything close to what we thought what everyone thought he was going to be.
That's not what Tim wanted to hear, but that's, you know what?
I need your keeper league, Tim.
Yeah.
Well, let me put it this way. I had Santana, Posey, and Wieters, and I traded both Santana and Posey this year and kept Wieters.
Bad move, brother. That's bad.
However.
Listen, we don't need you running the Indians, all right?
Well, tell me this. I got Scherzer and Mattis out of Santana and Posey. How'd I do?
Okay, that's good. Scherzer and Mattis are legit. Scherzer, Mattis has got good stuff, and Scherzer's got a big arm, man. Hey, I'll tell you what, that might be a good move for you.
Yeah, well, this is what the other 18 owners in the league aren't getting, the direct benefit of advice from Sean Casey. This is outstanding. Well, you know, as you look at this here, Sean, and you alluded to it in the course of our conversation, it has come to pass in his postseason debut tonight. Hard to believe that was the case for as long as he's been around and for as long as he's been great. Roy Halladay getting it done against the lineup that they'd set on the pregame show tonight on TBS that they'd proclaimed was the best in the National League, and I guess was by a couple of different measures that you use. But Philly seemed to be the consensus pick coming into the playoffs. I picked them to beat the Rays in the World Series. It seemed to be everybody picking them either to beat the Rays or to beat the Yankees, depending on how you look at it. I mean, you know, you'll get the earlier game today, and the Rays have got some work ahead of them, but boy, everything everybody thought about Philly, nobody's going to be changing any minds after game one.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, after watching Roy Halladay throw the second no-hitter in postseason history, I mean, it doesn't look like he's never been to the postseason before. I mean, and that's an impressive lineup. You know, make no mistake about it. They won the Triple Crown in the National League, the Reds, you know, in batting average, home runs, RBIs. He shut down a pretty legit lineup tonight for a no-hitter. I mean, that is a big, big statement the Phillies are sending right there. And they've been there. This is their fourth year in a row. They know what they're doing. They know how to win ball games. And, I you know, just watching them tonight was pretty impressive to see what they did, and especially Roy Halladay. But you also go to the other series with Texas sending a message, too, you know, having to face Price and go up against him. They really sent a big message with Cliff Lee really shutting down that offense today. And, then, you know, them Texas getting a big win on the road.
You know, a guy like Halladay, and you know, this year, and a guy like Cliff Lee last year, not a lot of postseason track record. Do some guys just have it, and it doesn't matter whether they've been in the postseason. Some guys just have that it factor, that, you know, whether or not they have any past postseason experience, they're going to show up and they're going
to
play.
Well, you know, here's the big thing for me, Tim. It's like you go tonight. You know, here's the tale of two games today. You got David Price, who's getting his first postseason start, right? And usually he's, you know, pretty locked in. Well, it looked like in baseball, you really got to back it down. You really got to slow the game down and let the game come to you. And it looked like, for me, Price was kind of all over the place. Really never established his breaking stuff early on. Was throwing mostly fastballs and getting behind in the counts, which it turned out to be leaving some balls up and getting hit early. And it just looked like he couldn't control that emotional side of him. He couldn't back it down and amp it down where he was hitting his spots. I mean, all his fastballs were up high, and that shows me that, you know, he was rushing a little bit, getting his front side out there, and his arm was dragging a little bit. Then you go to Roy Halladay, never been in the postseason, has, you know, 11, 12 years in the big leagues, but has a routine, knows what it takes, knows the demeanor that makes him the best on the mound, goes out there, and he does exactly what he does night in and night out. He doesn't worry. This is just another game to him, and I think that's the big thing. He didn't let all the hype, and this is your first postseason game, you know, get to him, just as similar as Cliff Lee did last year and did again today. So when you have a guy that has just experience to come into the postseason, it doesn't matter.
By the way, you know, we got here for you, Sean. You can clip and save this if you want. Your bizarre stat for the postseason here. I came across this in doing some research for a preview article for the FDHLounge.com, that this is only the third time in the 16 years of the division series that it has not been either Bobby Cox or Charlie Manuel in there. This is the second time it's been both of them. 2001, 2010, 2006, it was neither of them. What do you make of that, if anything, that it's been one or the other for 13 of the 16 years?
Well, it's impressive. It really is impressive. I mean, Charlie Manuel, obviously, I love Charlie Manuel. When I was with the Indians coming up, he was the hitting coach there. And, you know, the thing I loved about him was he treated me like gold, like he would treat Jim Thome like gold. You know, I was a 23-year-old prospect, and he was always coming up to me and Russell Branyan and Richie Sexton. We were the young guys. And, hey, who wants to hit, you know? I'm like, man, this guy really takes an interest in me, you know, and interest in everybody. So I look at Charlie. I'm not surprised at the success he's had with the Phillies and the success he had with the Indians. I mean, he's a winner, and it's pretty cool to see two old school guys like Charlie and Bobby Cox having such success, you know, in these last 16 years.
Yeah, they've been tremendous in everything that they've done. Have to ask you here in our remaining time. I knew that we wanted to get to some stuff with wrestling. First and foremost, I saw you reference this on Twitter. I guess that you're friends with Mick Foley, and there's a guy that's got a whole heck of a lot of stuff going on these days. Here, got the book coming out. They're going to make a movie about his life story. What's he got to say about that to you?
You know what? He just sent me one of those books today.
Okay.
It's funny he said that. He just sent me one of these books. Countdown to Lockdown, a hardcore journal. He just sent it to me and signed it. I just sent him a text saying, thanks a lot, dude, for sending me that book. So that was really nice. I'm in the book somewhere.
Really? Sweet.
He mentions me because I had him over at MLB Network a couple months ago, and he brought the raw copy of it and showed me where I was in it. I was like, that's one of the first non-baseball books I've ever made. So I thought that was big time. But I tell you what, man, pretty impressive what he did. And you know, I look back at all the matches he did and the passion he had for wrestling, and I think back to the Hell in a Cell match when he had with The Undertaker back in 98, of just how crazy you have to be to take a jump off the top of that cage and then take a slam through it and then keep going for 20 more minutes and then get a choke slam into some tacks. So Mick Foley's a legend. A legend in every sense of the word.
Well, and speaking of The Undertaker, you and I have something in common as far as somebody that we're a big fan of here. I go back to his last real big moment in the spotlight, 2002, delivering the spine buster there in the Sky Dome in Toronto. Double A Arn Anderson, I understand you're a huge mark of his. I'll tell you what, that when we've had on the show J.J. Dillon and other guys like that, I put this in front of them, and they always agree with me. There's a guy, man, he could have been world champion maybe at the right moment time there, maybe say 92, 93 in WCW. I mean, there's a guy who, you know, he could have maybe been the first of these anti-heroes to really break out and go big. There, I think there's no limit to what that guy could have done if given the ball.
You know what? I look back. I just got done reading some of his book. I know Steve was going to send that to me, but I ended up ordering it online. And then, you know, Arn Anderson talks about how, you know, he was really the enforcer for Flair and the Four Horsemen, and that you know, he really enjoyed that role, and that he enjoyed Ric Flair being the champion and him kind of being the sidekick and was the television champion and held a lot of other belts. But, you know, I think Arn Anderson is the epitome of what old-school, hardcore, you know, not so much hardcore, but just great wrestling was. You know, the history of wrestling, the guys that he respected when he was coming up. But just, I look at Arn Anderson, and, you know, it's funny because he was my favorite wrestler, and he was never world champion. And I think that says a lot because you talk to a lot of guys. I even talked to John John Cena, you know, last year, I think. We were having a conversation about who was your favorite wrestler, and he said Arn Anderson. So I was like, man, that says it all to me.
Oh, I can believe it, you know, and that's one of those things, too. I think Steve was telling me this, that I guess the one time when you were backstage at Raw, that I guess you were just marking out like a mother, weren't you, at getting to meet him in person because he works there.
Well, you know what, it was funny. I've been backstage a few times at WWE, and I walked up on him. And, you know, in our profession of baseball, you get to meet a lot of different people, you know, from rock stars to athletes, I mean, to actors, athletes. You know, everybody. And when I saw Arn Anderson, it was the one time I was like, hey, how you doing? Like, and just kept walking. I mean, I'm usually not at a loss for words, but, like, he's the only guy that kind of made me nervous. And people might think that's crazy, like, hey, man, you know, like, you're too big of a wrestling fan. But, you know, it's not even that. It was just more the Arn Anderson. I hit the aura he always carried when I was growing up.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he was tremendous. And, you know, it's one of those things, like when we had Jim Cornette on the show, too, you know, I told him that, you know, I used to boo the crap out of you when I was a kid watching it, you know, and I did with Arn, too. But, I mean, now I realize that's because Arn was playing his role to such a, you know, such a crescendo there, you know. I mean, that they can bring that reaction out of you and get you that, you know, into the moment to be booing them or in some cases cheering them even if they're a bad guy, you know. That just shows you how good they are, what they do.
Oh, yeah, you know, it was amazing, too, when he was talking, Arn Anderson and Ted DiBiase, and those guys were talking about, you know, back in the day when they would go down to Louisiana and those people were, you know, there was not really much security, and they would bring such a rise out of the people in the stands that when they would get out of the match, people would literally attack them going before they got back to the dressing room, and they would say they had to fight their way back to the dressing room. I just think that's absolutely unbelievable that, you know, people would take it to that kind of level. But that means you're obviously pretty good at what you're doing of firing up some people in the crowd.
Oh yeah, all the crowd heat you know, that they could draw, it was absolutely amazing. Who are some of the other ones that are on a short list of your favorites?
You know, I tell you what, I really appreciated Stone Cold Steve Austin, what he did. I know he was, really, obviously, he became one of the biggest WWE, you know, figures ever. But I loved, you know, just his act even before he was Stone Cold Steve Austin, even back when he was Stunning Steve and all that. I loved him. I loved, you know, even if you go back to, like, Rowdy Roddy Piper. I loved Rowdy Roddy Piper. I just feel like he was old school, too. And, you know, what he brought to the matches was pretty awesome. Piper's Pit and all that stuff. I mean, I go back to all those guys. I mean, the Hogans and the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. I love the Four Horsemen. I love the Road Warriors, Hawk and Animal. I love watching, you know, Animal's son, Laurinaitis, out with the Rams now. I mean, I loved all those guys. I was more into NWA, you know, back before it was WCW when they had this, you know, WTBS studio wrestling out there in Georgia. You know, I loved watching a lot of those guys.
You know what? I'm with you on that. You know, and growing up in the greater Cleveland area, we used to get TBS on the cable. And it's one of those things where I tell this story and, you know, a lot of people don't believe me. But if you were an NWA fan, you would believe me, Sean. I'll tell you what. Ronnie Garvin was over like neck bone at my high school, man. He was more over than Hulk Hogan. We loved us some Ronnie Garvin back in the day, man. That was a guy. It's revisionism the way people slam on him now for a bad title reign. He was over, man.
He was hands of stone Ron Garvin, man. He used to knock. He used to just bundle people, knock them out. Remember when him and King Kong Bundy? I believe they beat the Road Warriors on that WTBS. I remember. I was like, I can't remember how old I was, but I was so fired up. Because, you know, back in the day, they'd have, like, just the bums, you know, the player would face Teddy Long and just waffle him, put him in the figure four in like 6 seconds. And that was the one time there was like a legit match, you know, on it. Now there's legit matches every night, you know, on Raw and TNA. But, you know, back then it was, if you had a legit match, it was awesome. And I remember Hands of Stone, Ronnie Garvin, and King Kong Bundy winning the belts.
That was amazing, yeah. My favorite jobbers from back in the day, the Malkies and Alabama Junior Heavyweight Champion Mike Jackson. Boy, could that guy take some bumps.
That's great. I remember the Malkies, too. The Malkies, I always thought they were always so close to winning, and they just stunk.
Yeah, Malky Mania, man. That was that was some good stuff. Well, Sean, we always love to give everybody on a chance to show on the show here a chance to plug. You got a couple things going on here. I know you're very actively involved, and I really respect this. Catholic Athletes for Christ. As a Catholic myself, I can appreciate that. This charity that you're involved with Conan O'Brien, Labels Are for Jars. So anything at all that the people should know about, please take it away.
Well, the labelsareforjars.org is really a cool thing. It's a shirt, and you can get it. You can get a shirt in a jar. And you end up, it's a cool shirt. It has a label on it, and on the front of it, it'll say like, whatever. And you know, and we always thought labels are for drugs. Well, we raised money for this homeless shelter in Lawrence, Massachusetts. And over the last 3 years, we built this great facility, meal center for a lot of the homeless people or people that are starving. And we've served over 1 million meals in 3 years. It's been an unbelievable thing. And the other thing I would love to throw out there, and I appreciate you doing this, Rick, is that. I started this. I'm trying to build a Miracle League field here in Pittsburgh, but you know the connections. My wife's from Cleveland, so if anybody from Cleveland is listening, you know you can go to caseysclubhouse.org and check it out. And you know if you want to give a donation to us to help build this field for these disabled kids and that they can play baseball every day too, it would be a great thing.
That's awesome. We're gonna plug that on our site. That's some very good stuff. Have to ask you too, since Conan O'Brien, it says here on Wikipedia anyways, to the extent we can trust them, that he's a co-founder of this thing with you here. What have you been hearing from him? How geeked is he about the start of his show? What are you hearing through the grapevine?
I'm hearing he's excited. He's really excited. He's really excited about, you know, getting a chance to do WTBS, or TBS, and he's fired up about, just getting that opportunity. I what a shame that all that happened at NBC and with Jeff Zucker and all that craziness. I'm glad that, you know, Zucker ended up getting fired. But, yeah, I know Conan's really excited about it. It's gonna be just a great show. And he's, you know, for all the fans that watch him, he's got great material.
Hey, TBS, he's going to be the Dusty Rhodes of the new millennium, man.
He's going to be the Dusty. You know what's great? The other day, Rick, my buddy of mine does some directing down in Florida Championship Wrestling, and Dusty Rhodes runs it. He put Dusty Rhodes on the phone the other day. The guy was like, "Oh, it's the American Dream." So it's pretty cool for me.
Oh, that is pretty sweet. Well, Sean, we were looking forward to doing this. It wasn't easy to do, but it exceeded the expectations here. Would love to have you back. We just had so much fun with you, my man.
Yeah, we'll do it again, Rick. I appreciate it. And Tim, thank you. And tell Steve I said hello.
Oh, yeah, we will. Holy crap, this was a great segment. Thanks so much, Sean.
Sean, thanks so much, buddy.
All right, thanks, man.
Thanks, guys.
Sean Casey, everybody, Mr. Mayor, if you need him. What a tremendous guy. What a tremendous segment that was. There's guys, you know, they I'll use the wrestling analogy again. I mean, it was always said that, you know, Ric Flair, you know, he could carry a broomstick to a 5-star match. All you got to pretty much do is show up for a conversation with Sean Casey, Tim. He pretty much takes it away.
Just like sitting at the bar and talking to your buddies.
What a great guy. I'm glad you were up here early for that one as well as to help me break down Schleister.